Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 74, and the fourth installment of our All Things Boleyn series. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's great to have your company. Before we dive into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast, and thank all of my listeners who've taken the time to rate and review the show. Not only are your kind words a great source of encouragement, but they also help new listeners to find the podcast. Another way you can support the work I do is by becoming a Talking Tudors patron. It's easy to do. Just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. In keeping with our Boleyn theme this month, May's prize is Anne Boleyn's Most Happy Portrait pendant in solid bronze, made by the ever-talented Lucy Churchill. Lucy's reconstruction of Anne's portrait medal, which is the only contemporary likeness of the Queen to survive, is based on extensive research and is truly exquisite. Thank you to Lucy for sponsoring this incredible prize. I'd also like to invite you to join our Talking Tudors Facebook group, where you can chat with other Tudor history lovers and participate in our weekly Talking Tudors live chats with me. The next one is scheduled for the 23rd or the 24th of May, depending where you are in the world, so please join us if you can. Now, on to today's episode. I'm delighted that joining me on the show to talk about Anne Boleyn's execution and final resting place is Claire Ridgway. Claire is a Tudor history author, blogger and vlogger, known for her Anne Boleyn Files and the Tudor Society websites and of course her YouTube channel. She's also written a number of best-selling Tudor history books, including The Fall of Anne Boleyn, A Countdown and On This Day in Tudor History. She's presently working with Dr. Owen Emerson of Hever Castle on a book about the social history of the castle. My conversation with Claire straight after this musical break, courtesy of singer-songwriter Carlene. The song, To God I Commend My Soul, is from The Ballad of Anne Boleyn, Carlene's best-selling album inspired by the life of Henry VIII's second queen consort, Anne Boleyn.
Was I not good? Was I not true? Did I give you all I could? I bore you sons, born in blood. You can't blame me. What pleases God?
Welcome back to Talking Tudors, Claire. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Thank you for asking me to be a part of this.
Yes, I'm so glad that you said yes as well. I'm very excited. So since our last chat in December 2018, actually, unbelievable.
Oh, wow.
We've had a lot of new people find the show, which is great. So would you mind just introducing yourself to all our lovely listeners and just telling them a little bit about your background?
Okay, well, I'm Claire Ridgway. I run the Anne Boleyn Files and the Tudor Society websites. Oh, my bells, my church bells are ringing out. I've also written quite a few Tudor history books. I've been working full-time researching Tudor history for 11 years now. It started with a specific focus on Anne Boleyn, then it broadened to the Boleyn family, and then it broadened to Henry VIII's reign and kind of has been non-stop rolling out from there, really. I'm just a Tudor history nut. But yeah, my background, really, I grew up near Stratford-upon-Avon in the UK. My loves are religion, literature, writing and history, so that's all come together in what I'm doing now. This, it feeds all of my loves. But yeah, for a while history was a hobby. I used to be a primary school teacher, then I was a full-time mum, then I did freelance writing, and it just kind of grew from there. In my freelance writing, I decided to focus on history writing, and yeah, that's kind of how I came to be doing what I'm doing.
Wonderful. And I know a lot of our listeners will be familiar with all your wonderful work and websites and books.
Videos as well.
Oh, the videos. Yes, they're fantastic. I still don't know how you manage it every day, but I absolutely take my hat off to you, Claire.
I committed to that and now I'm kind of thinking,
how do you stop? You just can't stop now.
No.
Well, the topic for today's All Things Boleyn conversation is Anne Boleyn's execution and her final resting place. So can you paint a picture for us, Claire, of how Anne spent the last few days of her life at the Tower of London?
In prison, she was queen. She was given a household, not really a full household, but she was given ladies to attend her. So she was treated as queen, but a prison is a prison at the end of the day. Anne actually complained. She wasn't happy with the women that had been chosen to serve her. She wasn't allowed to choose who she took in with her. She couldn't have the women that were sort of loyal to her and that she was close to. And she said, "I think much unkindness in the king to put such about me as I never loved." And she was, the names that we have of the women who attended her include a Mrs. Stoner, two of Anne's aunts, Lady Elizabeth Boleyn and Lady Anne Shelton, who you'd think might, you know, be close to her and Anne would enjoy sort of having, well, not enjoy, but be okay having around her. But both of them had issues with Anne. Lady Shelton might have been angry with her niece because her daughter, Lady Shelton's daughter, had been kind of encouraged to keep the king happy and away from another woman at court that the king had been drawn to while he was married to Anne. Lady Elizabeth Boleyn and her husband James were supporters of Princess Mary. So even though they were related to Anne, they weren't particularly sympathetic to Anne. Then we have another lady, Margaret Coffin or Margaret Dimmock. And then we have Lady Kingston, who was the wife of the constable of the Tower, Sir William Kingston. And her job was to attend on the Queen, make sure the Queen was okay and had everything to make her comfortable, but to also give reports on what Anne had said to her husband, the constable, who then wrote daily dispatches to Thomas Cromwell. And the job of all these ladies was to act as spies, because Anne she did spend her time sort of rambling, trying to figure out how on earth she'd got to this kind of position, why she was in the Tower, what had she done. So in her rambling, she mentioned like Sir Francis Weston and that led to his arrest. She was trying to work out what she could have said to Henry Norris. and they were all reporting this back to they weren't supposed to speak to the Queen unless Lady Kingston was present, and then she reported back to her husband and he reported back to Cromwell. Anne spent her time sort of rambling. She would have spent her time reading. I expect her Bible and her Book of Hours were things that she relied on at this time. They would have been a real comfort to her. And yes, talking to these ladies, but they were ladies that she wouldn't have trusted.
Yeah, I can see why she wasn't totally happy with the situation, obviously. Now, when we talk about Anne's incarceration and her time spent at the Tower, a lot of the time there are questions about whether she witnessed the execution of her brother, George Boleyn. Can you comment on that, Claire?
Yes, yeah. The Tudors series is one of my guilty kind of secrets, really. I do love the Tudors. The Tudors. That scene, I bore my eyes out
when
you've got Natalie Dormer in that cell just sobbing her heart out. I can't watch it, really. That is an amazing scene. Because it just brings home to you the brutality of it and what Anne must have felt knowing that her brother and the other men were being executed. But in reality, there is absolutely no evidence at all that Anne witnessed it, thankfully. She wouldn't, from where she was, she wouldn't have been able to see Tower Hill, which is where the executions took place. The men were executed. If you've been to the Tower of London, it's actually outside the Tower of London and across the road up on Tower Hill. She couldn't have seen it from where she was. They would have had to have either taken her up to Tower Hill or moved her to one of the other towers. Well, Sir William Kingston was writing dispatches every day, as I've said, to Thomas Cromwell, reporting on the prisoners, all of the prisoners, not just Anne. And he makes no mention of any arrangements being made to move Anne or to take her to Tower Hill. So that idea is fictional. An amazing fictional device. It works very well in books and the Tudors, but no, there's no evidence for it.
All right. And if our listeners haven't seen that scene that we're referring to, it's heartbreaking.
Oh, but it really
is. Yeah, I recommend you pop it on and watch, especially I like to watch something, Claire, on May 19th. Sometimes I watch the Tudors, a few episodes of the Tudors to commemorate. So that might be a good one, although, you'll end up needing a whole box of tissues, I think, by the end. Now, there are many common myths about Anne Boleyn and the Tower that I'd love us to sort of touch on or clarify if we can, including that Anne spent her imprisonment in the lovely half-timbered buildings that stand today at the Tower of London, known as the Queen's House. This, however, is not the case. Nice story, but it's not the case.
Please
talk to us about the apartments in which Anne did spend her imprisonment. Where were they situated? You've mentioned that she wouldn't have been able to see Tower Hill from there. And what do we know of their appearance or their layout?
Okay, yeah, as you say, it's a nice idea, the Queen's House, because obviously it's something that you can actually see today. And I think the Victorians, even made like an Anne Boleyn room in it.
Yes.
And took people to it. And I think they even had Anne Boleyn etched on the fireplace. So, it's all very romantic and great for tourism. But the Queen's House, that half-timbered building on Tower Green, was not actually completed until after Anne Boleyn's death. So it's physically impossible for her to have been kept there. She was imprisoned in the Queen's apartments of the Royal Palace. There used to be a Royal Palace complex that dated right back to, the medieval times, a huge complex that had a great hall, beautiful royal gardens, privy gardens and royal apartments. And Henry VIII actually refurbished parts of the Royal Palace in 1533 for Anne Boleyn's coronation. Because leading up to a coronation, the monarch, or in this case, the consort, would spend a couple of nights at the Tower. They'd have banquet. There would be Knights of the Bath being knighted. And so they spend time at the Tower. So he had it all done up because, of course, and being crowned was a huge propaganda machinery went mad. He was making quite a statement. So he had it all done up, and the apartments where Anne would have stayed today, if you go to the tower, they would have been between the Lanthorn Tower and the Wardrobe Tower on the south lawn behind the White Tower. And if you do the wall walk at the Tower of London, if I remember rightly, there's an actual display which shows you what that area would have looked like at that time. You're kind of overlooking the Raven enclosure, and you've got the lawn ahead of you, and you're looking at the White Tower, and there's a plaque kind of thing that shows a plan of how the tower would have looked at the time. So she would have been staying in lavish apartments that have been done up. But as I said before, you know, even though it's luxury accommodation, a prison is a prison. She was there awaiting her trial and ultimately her execution. Unfortunately, they no longer stand today. They were demolished, I think, in the 18th century. They fell into disrepair and were eventually demolished. So it is really sad that we can't see them today.
I know, that's such a pity. And that plaque is there, definitely. I remember looking at it and thinking, oh, it's what really a pity useful. That it's gone.
And I think in the White Tower, the last time I went there, there is actually a kind of mock-up, a sort of 3D model of the tower at the time as well. But yes, it would be so lovely to see that great hall and the apartments and that.
Absolutely, what a pity. Now, Claire, another one of the common myths has to do with the scaffold site. So many visitors to the tower believe that the original scaffold site is on the current site of Tower Green in front of the Beecham Tower, or close to those lovely half-timbered buildings we spoke about. However, again, this is not correct, and it's not really helped by the beautiful monument to the executed that was unveiled there in 2006. So if we want to go to the tower and stand as close as possible to the actual scaffold site, where should we go?
Okay, well, here we have to say a huge thank you to the late Professor Eric Ives, who, for his biography of Anne Boleyn, the life and death of Anne Boleyn, just did an amazing job at piecing together like Anne Boleyn's final walk from her apartments to the scaffold using contemporary sources. And he notes that Anne was executed on a new scaffold before the House of Ordnance. And that means that the scaffold site was on the parade ground between the White Tower and the Waterloo Block. Now, the Waterloo Block is that big block that's got the jewel house in today. It's got the crown jewels. So today, if you visit the Tower of London, if you go to the parade ground between the crown jewels, the entrance to the crown jewels and the White Tower, and sort of stand where in the summer the queues are crazy for the crown jewels, if you stand where the queues are, you are standing pretty much where Anne Boleyn was executed. I mean, the memorial, the glass memorial, I do find moving, and it's lovely because it's not just a memorial to Anne, it's to all those who were executed within the confines of the tower. So, you know, it's still lovely. But yes, if you want to actually pay your respects at the point where she lost her head so brutally on that day, then yeah, go and stand near the Crown of Jewels entrance on that parade ground.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, to stand there and think that you're looking at pretty much the final thing that she saw, which is quite, you get goosebumps just thinking about that. And yes, the memorial is absolutely beautiful. And the poem, I can't recite it, I can't remember right now, but it is incredible isn't it?
But a lot of people say to me, oh, well, why can't they build a memorial on the spot? It's like, well, it wouldn't be practical. It's a parade ground. You really couldn't.
That's true. All right, Claire. Well, so what happened on the morning of May 19th, 1536?
Well, I'm not going to go into complete detail and do the speech.
No, I think we don't want to end up on teas.
Yeah. I'd need a box of tissues. I've only got one tissue here, so can't do that. Well, she actually thought she was going to be executed on the 18th. of May. Poor Anne, I psychologically, I don't know quite how you cope with that, then being told that you've got another 24 hours before your execution. So I suppose in a way she was well prepared for her death in a spiritual manner, because she'd prepared for the 18th. But yes, on the morning of May the 19th, she'd celebrated the Mass. She'd received the sacrament from her almoner at dawn on the 19th of May before eating breakfast. And then when Sir William Kingston came at 8 a.m. To her apartments to tell her that the hour of her death was near, she was already ready and waiting for him. She didn't need to prepare any longer. She was dressed in an ermine-trimmed grey damask robe, a crimson kirtle, which some have suggested she chose specifically to show that perhaps she was a martyr going to her death, but crimson actually was quite a common colour for kirtles. She was wearing a traditional English-style gable hood rather than the French hood that she is so associated with. Kingston then escorted her from her apartments to the scaffold, and he helped her up the steps. On the scaffold, she gave a speech, which, as I said, I won't recite, otherwise I'll be blubbing. Yeah. She took off the clothes that she needed to take off, so that, you know, she took off her hood and everything so that her neck was clear. She paid the executioner. She forgave the executioner for what he was about to do. It said that he was visibly shaken by what was going on. And she prepared by praying before her head was taken off, of course, by a sword rather than an axe. So she wouldn't have been, there's lots of misconceptions about how she was, there was a block used, but no, when a person was executed by beheading with a sword, they would have been in a kneeling upright position, and it was very important that they stayed still. Various people have sort of asked about who was present at her execution. There is no suggestion, thankfully, that her parents attended her execution. I would assume that they were back at Hever Castle grieving and comforting each other. I just can't get my head around how they must have felt at this time. They must have been absolutely heartbroken. Contemporary accounts suggest that in the crowd of spectators that day, we have Thomas Cromwell, Thomas Audley, who is the Lord Chancellor, Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk, of course, one of the King's best friends, and the King's illegitimate son, Henry Fitzroy, was well enough to attend the execution. Of course, he died not long after, really, but he was well enough at this time to attend. As I said, Anne Boleyn's execution had been postponed by 24 hours, and that is so Sir William Kingston could clear the Tower of foreigners. Perhaps ambassadors who might have written sympathetic reports of Anne's execution. There's no evidence. It is often said as well that Catherine Carey, Mary Boleyn's daughter, Anne Boleyn's niece, might have attended her execution and might even have attended Anne while she was imprisoned in the Tower. But we have no evidence of that. I mean, it's a wonderful fictional device again, that there's no record of her attending on a queen before she was appointed to serve Anne of Cleves in late 1539. But yes, I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about Anne Boleyn's execution.
Oh, it's heartbreaking. It's one of those things that no matter how many times you read it, you sort of just want it to be a different ending.
But, yeah. Yeah, you want someone, the king, to ride in and say he's changed his mind or something.
Yeah, and I always wonder what that last, you know, those last moments where she walked past those men that you just mentioned, Audley, Cromwell, what that must have been like. Did they look at each other? Oh, yeah. I just,
you know, and I wonder if she caught any of their eyes, you know, and her courage. I mean, it always strikes me. It strikes me with lots of people, you know, that the accounts of their executions, it was very important for them to to have a good death, to make a good end, you know, and to pray for the king, even though Anne knew that she was innocent, she still, you know, praised and prayed for the king. And it's just amazing the dignity and the courage that, you know, that Anne had on that day. It's just incredible. Absolutely. And the men, you know, we've quite often forget about the men, but yes, brutal.
Absolutely brutal. Now, you mentioned that she wasn't, of course, as some Victorian images would have us believe, executed with an axe and with a block and yes. all that sort of stuff. She was, in fact, executed with a sword. And it was a can you talk to us about the executioner, what we know of that person?
Yeah, we know very little about him, I'm afraid to say. All we know is that he was specifically ordered from Calais, which was an English territory at the time, and that he was known for his skill at decapitating people using a sword. So he was known in some circles as the hangman of Calais. He was just an executioner of Calais with particular skills with the sword. And he must have been ordered prior to Anne's trial, because Anne and her brother George weren't even tried until the 15th of May. And so for him to get to London from Calais, you know, he would have had to have been ordered beforehand. So that kind of shows you just how much her alleged guilt was a foregone conclusion. Some historical fiction has named him as Jean Rimbaud, but we don't know his name. I did know someone a couple of years ago who was researching the Calais archives, and he was going to let me know if he found anything for a name of an executioner in Calais at that time. But unfortunately, yes, it just never happened. So yeah, frustratingly, we know very little. Yes, a pain.
That is frustrating, isn't it, considering you'd think how many executioners were there in Calais at that
yes.
time?
Yeah. Oh, I suppose so it was one of those jobs as well where you don't really want to be known. You don't want exactly. people to know
That's
you.
That is true. And do we know, because you say, you know, we know that he was from Calais. Was he definitely French? Because obviously that was an English pal at the time.
He's known as the French executioner, the French swordsman. Mm. But I think that's just us saying that because Calais is now in France. Right. Yeah, I haven't been able to find out anything about him. I was really pinning my hopes on his name being in those archives, but I haven't heard anything back so far. And that was 2 years ago.
No. What a pity. Yeah. Now, you know, you mentioned that there was a delay in Anne's execution, and that in that time, Sir William Kingston used that to, of course, clear the Tower of Foreigners. But even though he did that, you know, word of Anne's execution spread quite quickly across Europe. So how did people in England and abroad react to the news of the execution of an anointed queen?
Well, Thomas Cromwell tried to do his best to spread the news that, you know, King Henry VIII had been saved from this huge conspiracy, this plot against his life that included not only his wife, but, you know, his best friends and favoured courtiers, people that he'd nurtured like Weston and Smeaton, who he'd even paid, you know, for their clothing. And he did a great propaganda kind of job. But there was lots of scepticism and sympathy. French scholar, printer and reformer Étienne Dolé, who knew Nicolas Bourbon, who Anne had helped bring over to England from France, Dolé published an epigram whose title translates to Queen of Utopia, condemned on a false charge of adultery and deprived of an epitaph. So that shows you how he felt about it, you know, false charge of adultery. Eustace Chapuis, the imperial ambassador, you know, a man who really didn't like Anne, who viewed her as a usurper of Catherine of Aragon's true title. He wrote of the men being condemned upon presumption without valid proof or confession, he reported that there were murmurings at the mode of procedure against her and the others. There was skepticism in his dispatches, and there were obviously murmurings around court at what had happened. Mary of Hungary, sister of Emperor Charles V, wrote that, as none but the organist confessed, nor myself either, people think he invented this device to get rid of her. George Constantine, Henry Norris's servant, Henry Norris being one of those who was executed for sleeping with Anne and allegedly plotting to kill the king, his servant recorded there was much muttering at the queen's death. So I assume that that was muttering at court in the circles that Constantine was moving in. We know that before Anne was executed, that there was a pamphlet going around London deriding the king's relationship with Jane Seymour that was being circulated. The king actually wrote to Jane to sort of tell her that he was dealing with it. So the people had got to find out that, you know, the king was actually involved with Jane Seymour. So that was going around. Don't think the common English people, the rest of the country, would have known about what was going on really before it was well over with. But there does seem to have been this feeling of shock and disbelief, these murmurings about what happened. So not quite as Cromwell would have hoped.
No, not quite as Cromwell would have hoped. And I imagine that their, you know, their parents, as you've said, and some of their other relatives and close friends would have just been utterly shell-shocked by the speed of it, by the brutality of it.
Yeah,
must have been really awful, absolutely awful.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people sort of criticize Thomas Boleyn, you know, for going back to court. You know, he was present at Prince Edward's christening and he climbed back into favor, but people forget that it was his duty. Yeah. Like the Howards and the Staffords before him, you know, if someone was executed as a traitor in your family, you had to then prove to the king that actually your family wasn't a family of traitors, and your duty as a nobleman in that kind of station, in that class, was to serve your monarch regardless. And that was a way of protecting your family as well. And he had to do that. He had no other choice. He had to put any personal feelings to one side and focus on the living. His wife, his daughter, Mary, grandchildren, and prove himself to the king. So I would get very upset when I see horrible remarks about Thomas Boleyn.
I know. It is quite awful. And I think that the ultimate proof lies in the fact that both he and Elizabeth lived not very long after the awful, awful, tragic deaths of their children. So I do think they were absolutely heartbroken.
Yes, me too.
Now, Claire, there exists more debate. There's so much debate about the Tower and this particular time in the Tudor history. So there's some debate as to exactly where Anne's body was buried in the chancel of St Peter at Vincula. So, you know, we know that there was an arrow box that was used that I know people have been asking about this particular arrow box and why she didn't actually have a proper coffin or something like that. So does she actually lie beneath her Victorian memorial plaque?
Well, in my personal opinion, yes. I don't actually see any reason to doubt it. Actually, beside me, you can't see because we're not obviously on video, but I've got one of my favourites books beside me, which is Doreen Seabell's book from 1877 on the Victorian restoration work. In 1876 and 1877, the chapel of St Peter at Vincula had become empowered. It was in a right old state, and it was decided that as it was a royal chapel, that it needed some refurbishment work. Now, they were going to leave the chancel area because they knew that obviously there were some prominent burials there and they didn't want to mess with it. But then it was found that the chancel floor was actually dropping. It wasn't stable. So restoration work had to be carried out in the chancel area too. A plan was drawn up by the Victorian team of the resting places of Anne Boleyn and others in the chancel, based on what Bell says he writes that it was down to consulting various historical authorities. So it was records from the tower as to where the burials were done. When they raised the floor of the chancel, they found the remains of a female where they expected to find Anne, where records said that Anne was buried. And they didn't find any other female remains near that spot. And according to tower records, the Dukes of Somerset and Northumberland were buried between two queens, Queen Anne and Queen Catherine Howard. And then they did find the remains of two males, the two dukes, exactly where they expected them to be too. Now, the remains of the female found in the spot where they expected to find Anne were then examined by the Victorian team's pathologist. And okay, they, you know, this was 1876, 1877, so they didn't have the technical help that we have today. But he didn't doubt that they were Anne. There were various bits, various neck bones kind of missing. People often say, well, wasn't it obvious from, you know, from the neck bones that she'd been decapitated by a sword? But there were bits missing because prior to this conservation work, there had been trouble with burials. Another coffin had kind of caused problems with the floor. So there had been sort of movement in the area. But I know there's this suggestion that actually those female remains could be Catherine Howard, or they could be Jane Boleyn, Lady Rochford instead. But I see absolutely no reason to doubt the identification, as Catherine and Jane were recorded as being buried further to the right as you look at the chancel, to the right of the two dukes. So I don't see any reason to doubt that those remains were Anne's. And as you say, they were buried in this chest that contained sort of bow staves. And people say, oh, well, didn't they find the chest? But obviously this, you know, 1876, 1877 is, well, 300 years after it happened. Yeah. And that had, it had rotted away. So no, but I don't see any reason to doubt it. They worked hard on making sure that they did everything right in that chancel area. And they did reinter her. All of the remains that they exhumed were reinterred actually in chests with a little plaque with the name of the person and the date of their death. So it was all done very properly.
Yeah, that is a fantastic account, that one that you mentioned. And no sign of George, though, right? They didn't find
him. No, they did, but they didn't go as far. I mean, if you're looking at the chancel, I think George was buried sort of behind Anne and to the left, sort of nearer the wall, and they didn't go quite that far. So no, they did the minimum really that they needed to do. It's beautiful how they've done it. I mean, the memorial tiles are lovely.
They certainly are. And now we've done a few of the sort of misconceptions, and I just wanted to touch on a couple of legends now, Claire. So there's a particular
legend.
We love the legends. There's a Norfolk legend that claims that after Anne's execution, her body was removed from the tower and actually reburied in Sole Church in Norfolk. So could you tell us about that particular story?
Yes, this Agnes Strickland, who I do love, Victorian author Agnes Strickland, wrote about this legend in her book. And yes, according to the story, Anne's remains were secretly removed from the tower and taken to Sole Church, the ancient burial place of the Boleyns. And she says, and there interred at midnight with the holy rites that were denied to her by her royal husband. I mean, that all sounds really romantic, doesn't it? That she was rescued from the tower where Henry had put her, and she was taken to this better place, and that she was then interred under an unmarked slab of black marble. Strickland does point out that there's no evidence to support this legend, but she quotes Sir Thomas Wyatt as writing, God provided for her corpse sacred burial, even in a place as it were consecrated to innocence. So there is this suggestion that the Wyatt family were in on this secret, had something to do with the removal of Anne's remains. And another book that kind of promotes this legend is Nora Loft's book, her non-fiction book on Anne, where she writes of her visit to the church and how she was shown a black marble slab by the sexton there. And the sexton told her that Anne Boleyn's ghost walks the church every year on the night of the anniversary of her execution. And that one night he was there on the 19th of May, and a great hare suddenly appeared in the church and led him a fine chase, apparently. And Lofts then explained to the man that a hare was one of the forms that a witch was supposed to be able to turn to at will, and that Anne was supposed to be a witch. So she was suggesting that this hare was Anne Boleyn. Oh, dear. Sorry. You can hear my scepticism. It's a wonderful story.
It's a wonderful story. It's very colourful, isn't it?
But, you know, there is just no evidence that she was moved. I'm sure the constable of the tower or someone would have noticed.
Yes, you'd imagine.
They would have been, I'm sure there would have been security following Anne's execution and burial to make sure that nobody did anything. And the fact that the Victorian team did find these female remains in the spot where Anne was recorded as being buried. It's great stories. And I'd also like to point out to Nora Lofts that there was no suggestion that Anne Boleyn was a witch anyway.
Yes, Blake, thank you. Oh, gosh. That one does drive me crazy, Claire, when I hear that one. Now, okay, maybe her body wasn't removed, but there is another legend that says that Anne's heart was buried in St. Mary's Church. And hopefully you pronounce it Irwerton, I think. Irwerton in Suffolk.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not a Suffolk person.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, Irwerton.
So what
yeah,
do you I'm make sure. of this tale?
Well, heart burial, some people don't know this, but heart burial was not unusual for the time. I mean, we have record of Jane Seymour's heart, for example, being buried in the Chapel Royal of Hampton Court Palace, yet the rest of her remains being in St. George's at Windsor. So heart burial, you know, is not uncommon, but it generally wouldn't have been done in, like, if a person is executed as a traitor, you're not going to honour a place by having their heart buried there. But yes, this legend is that Henry and Anne often stayed at Irwerton, or however you pronounce it, Hall in Suffolk, and that Anne loved the place so much that she left instructions that her heart should be buried there at the local church. And apparently renovations in 1838 at St. Mary's Church found a heart-shaped casket set into an alcove in the North Aisle. And legend has it that Philip Parker, a Boleyn relative of Irwerton Hall, was the one that was responsible for Anne's heart being put there. And the casket was then apparently reburied beneath the organ. And there's a plaque. I haven't visited the church, but apparently there is this plaque saying that Anne's heart is there. Again, there isn't any evidence at all for this legend. I've found no evidence of Anne leaving any instructions about where her heart should be buried, or even mention of her heart. Contemporary sources state that her remains, her complete remains, her head as well. Let's also debunk the myth that her head was put on a pipe Bridge. Yeah. Her head and body were wrapped in a sheet by her ladies. They were taken to the chapel of St. Peter ad Vincula, where they were, well, suddenly there was this panic. A chest was found from the armory, and her remains, all of her remains, were put in the chest and buried in the chancel. Lovely legend.
Yeah. And I did at one time try and find some evidence of Anne having visited that particular Irwerton Hall, but I couldn't. It doesn't mean that she never did, especially if there was a relation. But I didn't find any evidence of her and Henry having visited. But who knows?
She loved the place. But yeah, as you say, yeah, that's right. She loved it, but there's no mention of her even visiting it.
That's right. I love these legends. They're so great. Yeah. Now, talk to us, Claire, about the lovely anonymous floral tribute that's delivered each year on the 19th of May, so on the anniversary of Anne's death, to the Chapel of St. Peter ad Vincula at the Tower of London.
Oh, this is such a beautiful, beautiful tradition. I love it. And the yeoman warders at the tower authorities treat it as such an important thing and are so respectful of it. Each year, a basket of roses is delivered to the Tower of London with instructions for it to be placed on Anne's memorial tile in the chapel. The accompanying card with the roses just always simply reads Queen Anne Boleyn, 19th of May 1536. Doesn't make any comment on what happened, it just simply states that. When I was researching it all, I found an article from the Sunday Telegraph, which stated that a former director general of the Tower had investigated and that he'd found a flower order dating back to the 19th century. And there was a suggestion that the sending of this basket of roses was part of a bequest set up by Boleyn descendants. And I spoke to, this was quite a few years ago, I spoke to one of the yeoman warders about it. And what he told me sort of corresponded with that. They believe that it's a bequest and that there's still money for it to carry on running. And all of the yeoman warders, it's been happening all the time that they've been there. It's never stopped. And they take the tradition very, very seriously. And they don't like to lay down any other flowers on the spot until the basket has arrived. They like that to be the first thing that is put on her memorial tile. But I love the fact that when you go on the 19th of May to the Tower, that there are people there walking around with posies and bunches of flowers, which they hand over to the yeoman warders to place on the memorial tile, or they place themselves on the glass memorial in honour of Anne, and oh, some beautiful things written on cards with them. And I like to go up to the scaffold site on Tower Hill and leave a rose for George and the men there as well, because I think they get a bit forgotten, really.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing to do, isn't it, to stand close to where their human remains are. It's quite touching and quite an emotional experience for those of us who are drawn to this period.
Yes, very. Well.
All right, Claire, this has been amazing. I want to finish with a question from one of our listeners. So Christine has asked why you think Elizabeth I didn't have her mother reburied elsewhere.
Well, I think she thought it best to, well, I don't like using this phrase, but I can't think of any other way of saying it, to let sleeping dogs lie. Anne was buried in a chapel royal. St. Peter ad Vincula is a chapel royal in a royal palace. The Tower of London isn't just a prison, it's a royal palace. And it's all part of her burial spot, is all part of Anne's story. And Elizabeth's story too. We'll never know what Elizabeth thought of her mother being buried there. She never made comment on it, as far as I can see. But it's completely untrue that Elizabeth shied away from mention of her mother. I mean, she encouraged her mother's rehabilitation. Portraits of Anne were completed in Elizabeth's time. Books and treatises about her mother were written and published during her reign. For example, George Wyatt and William Latimer. And of course, Anne's mention as a Protestant martyr in the work of John Fox. And she made lots of use of her mother's falcon badge too. And she really identified with her mother. But I think that she focused on that, rehabilitating her mother that way, rather than drawing attention to her mother's end as a condemned traitor. That's just my personal opinion. I mean, people still say, I get constant comments about how the bells are ringing out for Anne here. I get constant comments about how Anne should be moved. She should be moved to Westminster Abbey. And I think, no, please, no. I mean, Westminster Abbey is too full anyway. But, yeah, Westminster Abbey is so busy. And it's really hard to stop and pause a while at any monument in there. Whereas St. Peter ad Vincula is so peaceful, so quiet. And sorry, there's a dog drinking behind me now. And you could just sort of pause there, and yeah, it's part of Anne's story, so yep. I think it's very fitting for her to be there. And it is a Chapel Royal; she is buried as queen. So, yes, that just my own personal opinions though on it.
Yeah, no, that's a great response.
We don't know. Elizabeth never spoke of the burial place, so we don't know.
No, and she's there with George, which is, you know, comforting, yes. I think. So, and they're, you know, the linked sort of that tapestry, as you say, the stories of Catherine Howard and the other people there, it's all kind of a tapestry, isn't it? And to remove one thread kind of seems odd.
And Elizabeth, somehow. You know, she knew the tower well. She'd been imprisoned there in 1554. So it's part of Elizabeth's story.
Yeah. That's so true. Now, Claire, the last thing I'm going to ask you is for a Boleyn takeaway. So something for our lovely listeners to go and explore after this episode, maybe a website, a song, or a book to read. Do you have a Boleyn takeaway?
Well, I would say, and I know this is hard because we're all in lockdown, but I would recommend visiting Hever Castle. And you can actually do this in a virtual way because on Hever Castle's Facebook page, I haven't had a look at their Twitter, but on their Facebook page, if you scroll further down, they've done some really good videos with Dr. Owen Emerson, one of my besties, good old Owen, who's the castle supervisor. Owen and I are actually writing a book on Hever Castle, and Owen is kind of introducing different parts of the castle. So although I would normally recommend visiting Hever Castle, that can't be done at the moment, and for some people it's impossible anyway. But yes, watch the videos, read about Hever Castle. I've got a video on the Anne Boleyn Files and Tudor Society YouTube channel about me holding Anne's Book of Hours and interviewing Owen about them. It's, for me, Hever is, I get more of a sense of the Boleyns at Hever than I do at the Tower of London. Hever is the place that Anne called home. It was where she spent happy times with her family. It's where she retreated to when Henry was hassling her, when he wanted to court her and she wasn't having any of it. She retreated to Hever. It's where she fought off sweating sickness. It's where she was sent to when Wolsey was trying to work on the annulment and they thought it was best diplomatically to get her out of the way. It's where she was at key points during her life. It's where her parents would have grieved for her and George. And it's just a stunningly beautiful place. There is this myth that none of what you see today is original, or Anne wouldn't know it. That's completely untrue. I mean, Astor, Captain Seabright before him, that they've done beautiful work on it, but it's still, there is so much there that Anne knew and would recognise. You can literally walk in Anne and George's and the Boleyns' footsteps there. You can see things she would have seen. You can walk on floors she would have walked on, touch walls that she touched. And you can see her two books of hours, which would have been so important to her. Books of hours were books that she would have used constantly throughout the day at the, you know, the offices, the Catholic offices during the day, that she would have read from. Oh, it's just, you get such a sense of her there, and it's my happy place. Yeah, one of my top favorite places. So if you can go there physically when all of this has blown over, but if you can't go there physically, then do have a look at Hever Castle's Facebook page, at their sort of video section, because Owen's done a wonderful job at bringing the castle to life through video.
Yeah, that's so wonderful. And also listen out for the episode with Dr. Owen Emerson, Claire's bestie, which is coming up as well. And he has done such an amazing job of bringing the castle that Anne would have known, you know, at the time the Boleyns owned it, to life. It was just amazing. And like I said to him, you know, when they reopen their doors, I think I'm going to be the first person on the other side, just like, hi.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, him and Alison, who's the curator, they've done an absolutely fantastic job with research and that into the Boleyn's time, particularly at the castle. It's such a wonderful place to visit.
It sure is. And Claire, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your expertise.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Talking Tudors with me again. I really appreciate it.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is on the Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as the Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.